I remember when I was trying to learn Spanish, Nebuchadnezzar was one of those really hard words. Nabucodonosor. Almost as bad as Deuteronomio, Deuteronomy. We're going to talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego this morning and the fiery furnace. And you'll notice that Bonnie read to a certain point, and it's almost like those sitcoms or those shows like Prison Break or whatever it is that stop right at a crucial point and leave you hanging, right? Well, we're going to leave you hanging this morning because we want to focus on that first part. So today, for those of you that are new, we're concluding our series on vision. And you might wonder what this has to do with vision. I hope you'll find out. But an important component about vision is what I call commitment and buy-in. You can have vision, you can put it on the wall, you can put it on really fancy paper and put it in a filing cabinet, you can put it behind glass, you can do whatever you want with it, but if you actually don't live it out or do anything or commit to it, it actually doesn't mean a whole lot. It's not worth a whole lot. And today we're going to find out that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had their commitment and their buy-in put to the test. A test that most of us probably won't ever face. It's important. This is the second miracle mentioned in the book of Daniel, and it's one of the many great stories in Scripture that point to commitment and buy-in. And it's funny that the same experience that Daniel had where fellow rulers devised a plan to get rid of him because he had integrity. Here you again have others wanting to get rid of them because of their integrity. The story seems to repeat itself. Also, if you're interested, if you read the chapter prior to this one, well, there was this whole vision that Daniel interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar, which suggested that he had feet of clay. And he follows this up with building a statue to himself. Did he not catch on to what Daniel had just said the chapter prior? Well, number one this morning, I want to tell you that a yes to something also means a no to something else. A vision statement is important not only in terms of what you have committed to do, it also is important in terms of if this is what I've committed to do, that also means that however good this is, I'm not doing it. A yes to one thing also means a no to something else, and both aspects are important. I think it was last week that I told you that Lowen Windows refuses to sell donuts because their vision is doors and windows. It's important. And my next plan is to talk to Josh about Bartman Concrete. Maybe they'll sell donuts. Not. Vision is important. You've got to be focused. Well, our story today, the premise of this chapter is the enforced worship of Nebuchadnezzar's golden statue. It was his way of compelling a display of loyalty, a test of allegiance. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. This is a test of allegiance. This wasn't just a religious thing. It was also a patriotism. It was a test of loyalty. And for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, this was also a test of their allegiance to Almighty God. That's the way they viewed this. This was a watershed moment, a test of how strong their allegiance to God was. We notice from the text that the three friends attended the ceremony, but they did not fall before the statue and worship. So they were there, like everybody else. While everybody else was on their knees, or probably prostrate on the ground, here's these three guys standing, like a sore thumb. They stand out. They're refusing to bow. They're refusing to fall down and worship. And we notice that their allegiance to God exceeded their allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. Yes? They had allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. They were, just like Daniel, they were faithfully serving in this kingdom. But there was a line they were not prepared to cross. There was a line that they drew in the sand that said, we will serve faithfully, but up to here. Now, this wasn't an easy thing. Why? Because the king's decree was also backed by a powerful threat. And we notice, as Bonnie read, whoever did not worship would be cast immediately into a burning fiery furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar backed up his desire to have people bow and worship to his image of himself with a threat that if you don't, the consequences are more than just missing a meal. Nebuchadnezzar climaxes his exhortation with a statement that gets at the heart of the theological teaching of this chapter. Notice in verse 15 what he says. What God will be able to rescue you from my hand? I'm the big guy here. I'm the guy that decides your life is in my hands, and if you don't follow what I want from you, what God? There's no God that will rescue you from my hand. But Daniel's three friends don't give two hoots about the royal decree or the threat. By accepting this statue into the category of deity, they would inevitably reduce the true God and demote him in such a way that they would make him out to be no more than one of a bunch of other deities in a polytheistic world, i.e., not God at all. Ultimately, and here's my beautiful alliteration this morning, the diluting or diminishing of deity is a denunciation or denial of deity. You missed that. Let me say that again. Yeah. Ultimately, diluting or diminishing of deity is a denunciation or denial of deity. You can't reduce God and still have him be God. You can't. And you and I as human beings can't figure him out completely either, because then he wouldn't be God. So there needs to be a certain amount of humility. I can't explain him completely. Notice also, importantly, we talked about Noah in Sunday school, adult Sunday school, and if you're not attending, you're missing, of course. The three were alone. These three were alone. They were exiles in a strange land with no one to encourage them in their faith. They stood up, and maybe you and your job, maybe you're the only believer in your classroom at school or in your job or whatever, you feel very alone. Well, you're not the first person to face that scenario. And they were surrounded by backstabbers who sought their destruction, just like Daniel with the other administrators and satraps. Point number two. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had stubborn faith. The three friends begin by acknowledging God's ability to save them. Yes, God can save us. But then, very importantly, they envision the possibility that God may choose not to do so. Oh, we could go all kinds of places with this. I've often said that I don't hold to health and wealth gospel. But if I believe that God always has to heal me when I pray, if I believe that he always has to make things work out the way I want, then don't I believe in health and wealth gospel? And how many other martyrs have there been throughout church history that didn't get the ending that they wanted? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they answer Nebuchadnezzar in light of the possibility that they will be burned to ashes in a blazing furnace. Whatever the case, they say that they will not worship the golden image. I call that stubborn faith. I call that an attitude of stubborn faith. And it reminds me of Job in Job 13:15, where he says, "Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him." Wow, that's a statement of faith. Even if he slay me, even if he allows me to die, I will continue to trust in him. Yes, the three friends survive, but they also know that some of God's faithful have died at the hands of persecutors. I read a quote, I think it's behind me. Courage is simply the willingness to be afraid and act anyway. Courage doesn't mean that you're never afraid. Courage doesn't mean that when you face circumstances in life that are really, really hard, that you're not allowed to feel fear. That's like the guy that hits his finger with a hammer and says, "Praise the Lord, I didn't hit my other finger." No, that hurts. That hurts. We don't live in denial. We don't pretend that something doesn't hurt. But courage is moving forward anyway. It's a willingness to act despite the fact of being afraid. Was this situation where others have died because God was unable to deliver at those times? Or was it because the others did not have enough faith? And just a side note to those of us that go and visit someone who is palliative or dying, please don't you dare say, "By the way, if you had more faith, you'd be healed." Or it's because of sin in your life that you're sick. Or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is tantamount to kicking a man when he's down. You and I actually cannot read the intents and purposes of the heart, so that's a judgment you and I are not prepared to make. That's above our pay grade. So if somebody is really struggling, then we come alongside and we encourage. We don't say, "You're in this because you lack faith," or "You're in this because of sin in your life." No, for those that died in a fiery furnace, it was that God in his unfathomable wisdom did not choose to save them. No matter what the result, deliverance or death, they would not give in to the evil powers. They would stay faithful to God. That's serious buy-in. They calmly and bravely proclaimed their faith without a moment's hesitation. And by the way, as you read the passage, they say, "O king," in Spanish it says "usted" instead of "tú," which is the formal, which is the polite. They were polite to Nebuchadnezzar, but they stood their ground. They did it respectfully. Their courage is remarkable. They did not seek death. They're not masochistic, but neither did they shrink from it. And I suspect this has tremendous implications for how we think about suffering today. The story of church history, from its beginnings under the Roman Empire to the present, has countless stories of faithful witnesses who stood firm to the end. Read that last paragraph in Hebrews 11, where it talks about those that were torn apart, etc., etc. Or those of us that call ourselves Mennonite or Anabaptist can read in Martyr's Mirror 1525 on how many of the Anabaptist forefathers were martyred. In fact, the first bunch of Swiss Anabaptists, most of them were university students that hadn't reached 30 years of age, and most of them didn't reach 30 years of age. They were martyred before that. Buy-in, commitment. Jesus said, "No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other." Matthew 6:24. The desires of this world conflict with the will of God. And compromise approaches us subtly like a prowling lion. That's probably why it's so dangerous. Compromise doesn't require complete submission to worldly ways or ideas. Rather, it encourages us to accommodate them. Compromise never asks us to abandon Jesus and embrace an idol. Compromise says that we can have the idol and keep Jesus as well. You can have your cake and eat it too. There must be a place on the shelf for one more idol, right? Besides, what harm is there when Jesus is still there? you and I need to watch that we don't compromise our walk with Christ. As a quote says that I read this last week, compromise is planned failure. Compromise is planned failure. And you and I can't withstand the threats of the world unless we develop a stubborn faith. Solomon in Proverbs 4 says, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. We noticed in Sunday school that the difference between Cain and Abel was the heart issue. Today, we noticed when we talked about Noah, the difference between him and a fallen generation was a heart issue. Guard your heart, because everything flows from it. While Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are long gone, but their faithful courage and boldness continues to echo throughout history, and their voices speak to us from the past. These three men likely never saw their homeland or their families again. They were aliens in a hostile and foreign land. Still, they chose to glorify God. Their resolve and their commitment was firm and unshakable, even in the face of death. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you and I are foreigners, are aliens in a foreign land as well. The threat of idolatry is much more subtle and therefore threatening to us today. Paul Tillich wrote, a person's God is the thing or person that one is most concerned about, thinks the most about, or affects one's life the most. Bill Bright from Campus Crusade said it a little easier when he said, who is on the throne of your life? Who or what is on the throne of your life? If it is not the true God of the Bible, then it is an idol. And John Calvin provocatively said, the human mind is a factory of idols. The human mind is a factory of idols. We are constantly, even as Christians, in a struggle with this temptation. The temptation comes from a variety of sources, not all of which seem so bad on the surface. We're addicted to pleasure, to looking out for number one. That's an idol. We seek power in order to control our world. That's an idol. We make relationships or a particular relationship an idol. The list is vast, which is why the danger is so real. The seduction is subtle, which is why we can slip so easily into idol worship. But though subtle and varied, idolatry, whether of Nebuchadnezzar's sort or the kind we discover in our own hearts, ultimately has one objective. When the masks are ripped away, behind every idol is the self. It's not so much a ridding the world of a god, but replacing God with another god, the self. All substitutes for God are ultimately this idol, the idol of self. North American Christians, in spite of all of our complaints about infringements on our religion, are rarely, if ever, confronted with the kind of decision faced by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I'll have to tell you that this is not true of Christians in many other parts of the 20th century world, where their faith and witness can lead to prison terms or a death penalty. Some of us were here when our Afghan family shared, and we suddenly found out how real that could be. I happen to have it in good faith that the believing church in Iran is a million strong, where you're actually not allowed to publicly proclaim allegiance to Christ. Faith clings to the conviction that God is able to save us from any danger, but faith also affirms that whether or not God does save us is a matter for Him to decide. Whether or not God chooses to act, we, like the three Hebrews facing a fiery death, must continue to trust Him. Joshua told the Israelites before entering the Promised Land, if serving the Lord seems desirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your ancestors beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Jesus put it this way in Matthew 7, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. A faith that does not result in activity of any kind consistent with that faith is dead faith. It's empty, worthless, and insincere. I think a modern-day example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's stand would be the case of August Landmesser. I'm not sure if I pronounce his last name right. But he refused, you can see that circle there, he refused to perform the Nazi salute in 1936. He's standing out like a sore thumb in the midst of everybody else saluting. And, of course, he ended up going to a concentration camp as a result. There are some very tangible ways to measure your commitment or buy-in this morning, and I'm going to mention a few. How much of our resources do we contribute to the work of God's kingdom as compared to what we spend on ourselves, on our own comforts, pleasures, needs, and wants? If you're sitting here this morning and you have not ever received a charitable tax receipt, I wonder where your commitment lies. How much of our time do we contribute to serving others or to our collective work of ministry as a church as compared to time spent on self and personal pursuits? In other words, if you're not serving in the church and you're not serving out in the world, you're spending all of your time on yourself, I think that kind of says something about your commitment. I'm going to slip out the back after, just to avoid any backlash. But I've got to be honest with you. We do well to ask ourselves frequently, what is the most valuable thing in my life? Then we should evaluate where we have spent our time, what we have invested our life pursuing, and where we have spent our money, our resources, and what's valuable to us. Actually, although I didn't pursue a career in accounting like I thought I would, God had other ideas. Good accounting, whether of time, relationships, or money, is a good gauge of our values. When push comes to shove, if you are being charged with being a follower of Christ, is there enough evidence to convict you? You catch what I'm saying? If I was being charged with being a follower of Christ, would there be enough evidence to convict me? Would your buy-in and my buy-in and commitment be obvious and indisputable? So here's your homework for the week before I call Jesse up to see if we have some questions or comments. Here's your homework for the week. Do some introspection this week. Think about where your primary commitment and buy-in is. Where is it? And what are the things that you've identified that lead you to that conclusion, i.e., where are you spending your resources? And I'm not saying that all of it has to come to the church, but where are you spending your resources? And where are you spending your time? Are you serving? Are you loving your neighbor? I had a funny incident this week. A fellow stalled his car right close to our house. And he asked if I had jumper cables. A young man looked a little rough around the edges. I said, absolutely. I drove the car up, tried to start it a couple of times, and we finally gave up. And as I drove back, he tried again, and it started briefly. So I went back with the car and tried again. And anyway, long story short, he didn't have minutes on his phone, so I called his dad for him to come from out of town to get him. And as I was walking back and stuff, I said, you know, we got to love our neighbor. And Diane says, he's not your neighbor. He doesn't live on the street. And I says, your definition of neighbor? I'm not throwing her under the bus. We have these conversations all the time. What's the definition of neighbor again? Opportunities come to us all the time. Take them. Seize them. I think that guy remembers me. I kind of think so. And actually, it doesn't matter to me if he does or doesn't. And I'm not trying to earn my way into heaven, by the way. That's been figured out already long ago. It wasn't based on my effort. But my commitment and my buy-in has to work itself out somehow. It has to demonstrate itself. Right? All right, Jesse, why don't you come up? Let's see if I'm in trouble.
have two thoughts here so far. How do we prepare to equip and train people for service and then set them free to serve in other churches and locations? Success is in the training and releasing of people, not in collecting bodies. If we don't send or release them, God can do it for us, and this can be painful. This is painful.
My short answer would be that I think we need to do gift and calling discernment in the life of the church. And I'm not talking about a program here. I'm talking about that somehow that is part of what we do with our youth when we have a youth program, is walking through that. We do that in Sunday school. We do that when, as a Sunday school teacher, I tap somebody on the shoulder and ask him if he wants to help me, and I'm wanting to mentor him, or sound people, or praise band. Like, that somehow there's an effort, and it can be informal, but there's an effort to assess gifting and calling. What's God's call on your life? In my own life, I had a gentleman tap me on the shoulder and believe in me, and it ended up sending me to the mission field because of somebody that did that. So I'm not talking necessarily about a class. I think that can happen, have a class about spiritual gifts, etc. But I think it has to be broader than that. I think all of us that are in some teaching role, and I realize probably with the children's church that's a bit early, but some emphasis on gifting and calling, praying about it, talking about it, and then encouraging involvement.
Can I share something?
Absolutely.
There, in my parents' church in Southern Ontario in Tillsonburg, their pastor decided to move away, and so their church was without a pastor, and a different church, a different denomination, heard about this and said, we need to help our brothers and sisters over there. And they sent one of their pastors to go and pastor my parents' church. And I thought that was a beautiful thing, a beautiful leaving of another person in another church to go. And they just saw them as the brothers and sisters in the community, and they need help. And they went and served there. So I just thought that was a really beautiful example of how that was worked out there. Is compromise always planned failure, or are there areas where compromise is the way to get along with others? If we can't compromise on any spiritual issue, don't we make all issues into cardinal beliefs?
That's loaded. That can go so many directions. When I call compromise planned failure, what I'm talking about is compromise on my commitment to Christ and that. Obviously, we don't hold to a hierarchy here, and we believe in exegesis and community, and when we have congregational meetings, we have everyone speak to an issue and we come to a decision together. So there is some level of compromise in that. But for instance, if somebody is going to say that I don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that he was God himself, I'm not willing to compromise there. I'm standing my ground on that one. Right? So yes, those of us who are married know that compromise is an important aspect of married life, so that you don't have to sleep with one eye open. I realize that. And iron sharpens iron. So all of those things apply. But I'm talking about a commitment to God that doesn't waver.
Yeah. That's everything.
Okay, praise band, why don't you come up? Thank you, Jesse.